Chapter 3. The Flying Dutchman jumped into the outskirts of a star system centered on a dwarf star that was the perfect shade of yellow to remind me of Earth's sun. Seeing that star reminded me that our sun was considered a yellow dwarf star, which still kind of pissed me off. Not all the emotions brought up when looking at images of that star were happy ones. I was very homesick and very worried about my native planet, and the crew, I am sure, felt the same way. Damn, it had been a long time since we had seen the familiar sunlight of our home. The mission UNEF Command sent us on was supposed to be relatively quick. Contact a relay station to confirm the Theranin were not sending a second surveyor ship to Earth, then swing by to recon the situation on Paradise on our return voyage. The whole mission should have taken 4, maybe 6 months at most. Instead, because the universe hates me, we could not simply contact a Theranin relay station. We had to board and capture the damn thing. Then we had to wait for data to roll in, so we had flown off to Paradise and gotten involved in securing the future for the humans trapped there. Even after we confirmed absolutely that the Theranin were not interested in sending another ship on a long voyage to Earth, we had not been able to return home because we had to stop the freaking Ru'ha from sending a ship. Somehow, sparking a vicious civil war among the Kristang had been the easiest solution to that problem. With that unplanned mission accomplished, we were now unable to go back to Earth because our idiot alien AI beer can couldn't keep himself out of trouble. AI usually meant artificial intelligence, but Skippy said there was nothing artificial about him, and he thought the A should stand for awesome. My opinion is that regarding Skippy, the A meant asshole. I didn't know if we would ever return home. Until we could find a magical elder conduit thingy and Skippy could fix himself and kill the worm that was trying to kill him, we didn't have any way to return home. So I was taking things one step at a time and not thinking too far ahead to avoid getting my hopes up. The universe loved to stomp on my hopes. "Joe, are you all right?" Skippy asked. "Your eyes are moist. I would assume this is caused by allergies, but there are no detectable allergens in the air, so I am guessing you are experiencing an emotional response." "I'm homesick is all, Skippy," I replied, and didn't try to hide my feelings from the crew. From the CIC, Chang nodded and gave me a thumbs-up sign. "Ah, it is understandable that you would have that particular reaction here, for this star system is similar enough to your home. The spectral signature of the star is within 2% of your sun. The third planet here is habitable and reasonably Earth-like, although gravity there is 12% higher and the mean surface temperature is significantly warmer. The fourth planet, our target, is quite like Mars, except it is almost 50% more massive." "It's red, right?" I tried to recall some of the less important data from the briefing. "Correct. The surface dust is reddish from iron oxide, but more grayish than on Mars, and it has a very thin atmosphere, even less than the atmosphere of Mars." A sun-like star, an Earth-like third planet, and a red planet like Mars. It did feel like home away from home. "Is there anything unique or special about our home system, Skippy?" "No, not really." Maybe he sensed we needed to hear something encouraging right then because he paused. "Several things, actually. The most obvious is that Earth's moon is the same apparent diameter as your sun when seen from Earth's surface, so a total eclipse of the sun allows a view of the sun's outer layer. There are only two other planets in the galaxy I know of with that same feature, and only one of them is habitable. Earth is also the only one of the three to evolve intelligent life." He didn't even take the golden opportunity to make a disparaging remark about humanity's lack of intelligence. "Other than natural astrophysical features, I would say the most special and unique element of your star system is that it is home to a species of grubby monkeys who have been totally kicking ass out here. All the other stars in the galaxy are burning with jealousy, Joe." "I thought they were burning hydrogen." "Oh, for—" he sighed in exasperation. "I tried to give you a compliment, and you—" "I'm screwing with you, Skippy. Thank you. Genuinely, thank you. That ranks up there in the top 10 nicest things you've ever said."
"I have said 10 nice things to you? Huh, I can only remember 3. Damn, I must be slipping."
"It was a joke, Skippy.
Now what are the sensors showing you?
They are showing just what I expected, Joe. Our target planet is on the opposite side of the star from the heavily populated third planet. Those two planets are now 390 million kilometers apart. What matters more to our upcoming mission is that a speed of light signal will take over 20 minutes to travel from our target to the third planet.
Skippy was correct. Signal travel time and not distance is what we cared about. According to his data, the fourth planet had only a couple hundred permanent residents at a military research facility there. That population number could increase when a supply ship visited twice a year, but the next ship wasn't scheduled to arrive for another 2 months. In orbit was an armed space station with weapons for self-defense and to support the bases on the surface. Nothing the Wargalan had there was a serious threat to the Flying Dutchman, even in our ship's weakened condition. That assessment was Skippy's analysis, but of course Skippy didn't have much to worry about when missiles started flying and maser cannons began firing searing bolts of energy. We cared about time because the mission we planned was not one of our usual super-ultra-mega-stealthy infiltrations where no one knew we were ever there. This was, as Major Smite described it, strictly a smash-and-grab op, perfect for pirates. We did not have time to sneak around, and there was no way for us to get at the conduit thingy Skippy needed without all of the native residents knowing something bad was going on. So we were going in heavy. With support only from Skippy the Meh, we would not be able to prevent emergency signals from being sent out from the planet and space station. About 20 minutes later, those signals would reach the third planet, which had a population of nearly 8 million Wargalan, a rudimentary network of strategic defense satellites, and a frigate permanently stationed in orbit. With the Dutchman weakened by repeated disasters and no access to spare parts, even that frigate could be a problem while our star carrier lingered in orbit waiting for the away team to return. There were some wild cards we could not know until we arrived at the star system, and some others we might not know until we jumped into orbit of the fourth planet. First, where was that Wargalan frigate? If it was in orbit around the third planet, then it could not possibly know there was a problem at the fourth planet for 20 minutes. Even if that ship happened to be powered up and ready, it would need to climb out to jump distance and transition to near the fourth planet. Simply jumping in near the fourth planet would not make the frigate useful, for its momentum would be carrying it in the wrong direction and would need to burn hard just to match course and speed with the planet. Even so, that ship did not need to match course in order to launch missiles and fire maser cannons and railguns at the Dutchman. To be safe, I told Major Smite to plan the mission to take no longer than 30 minutes from the Dutchman jumping in to us jumping away. The ever-confident Smythe admitted that was a difficult task, but I knew secretly he relished the challenge. If that frigate could not be detected in orbit around the third planet, I intended to abort the mission. There was a risk that another Wargalan ship was visiting the system, but Skippy was strongly confident he would know of another ship's presence by tapping into the local communications network. The final risk to us was the military garrison on the fourth planet. A wing of combat dropships was stationed there, and occasionally one or more wings arrived from the third planet for training. The away team would be flying advanced Theranan Condors, with cover provided by Theranan Falcons. Our Theranan dropships were more than a match for anything the Wargalan could throw at us, but a large number of Wargalan combat aircraft could overwhelm our air cover and pose a serious threat. Okay, so the planets are where we expected them to be. I pressed Skippy for more useful information. Have you located that frigate yet?
No, Dum-Dum. We are 6 light hours from the third planet, and I'm stuck using this ship's crappy passive sensors. From way out here, a frigate is a tiny dot, Joe. If it is directly in front of or behind the planet, I won't be able to see it until...
Oh, got it.
Yep, frigate is there, orbiting about 3,000 kilometers above the third planet. From its infrared signature, the engines are not powered up. Keep in mind, Joe, this information is 6 hours old. That frigate could be anywhere by now.
But that's unlikely, right?
The frigate is an old ship and spends most of its time in orbit. This is not a wealthy or strategically important star system, so funding for operation of that ship is limited.
Great. I am relieved to hear that. Any news yet about other starships around here?
Decrypting military comm traffic now. There was no mention of a visiting starship on the unencrypted civilian comm network, and a warship making a port of call at such a backwater planet should be a newsworthy event, like for merchants eager to provide services to the ship and crew. Wow, the Wargalan have shockingly inadequate encryption. Or maybe it is only low-priority star systems like this that use a poor encryption scheme. Okay, I'm in the military network. Good news and bad news. A pair of destroyers visited this system 4 months ago. The next scheduled port call from the Wargalan fleet is not for another 3 months. So, unless the Wargalan have a stealthed ship here that has not revealed its presence to the local authorities, there is only that single frigate in the system. That is great. I refrain from pumping a fist in the air. What is the bad news? A second wing of dropship fighters has deployed to the fourth planet for training. They were delivered by the frigate 17 days ago. Now let's see if I can find more information. Okay, this might be good. Yep. I have a report from the wing commander dated 2 days ago. She reports training exercises have proceeded as planned, and half the wing is standing down for a 4-day maintenance cycle. Joe, that means 16 of that wing's 32 dropships will be offline when we arrive. It also means we have to contend with 16 additional combat aircraft, plus the 32 of the wing permanently stationed there, I reminded him. Not all of those 32 will be flightworthy at the same time, Joe. You know how logistics works. So maybe 4 of them will be offline. That leaves 44 pissed-off fighters crawling all over the sky, and we only have 4 Falcons to keep them away from our pair of Condors that carried the ground assault team. You're forgetting about the Dutchman's own combat power. From orbit, our Mazers can strike targets in the atmosphere. You told me the Dutchman is not an ideal orbital weapons platform, and that our targeting sensors are not designed to lock onto small aircraft at a distance. What Skippy told me was that highly maneuverable aircraft flying even a half-light second away would be nearly impossible for the Dutchman's slow-reacting Mazer cannons to hit, and we couldn't waste precious missiles on mere dropships. That is true, Joe. But the Wargalan don't know that. A couple Mazer shots from the Dutchman should make them scatter their formation, preventing them massing for an attack on the Condors. You think? I do think. But you are the military tactician, not me. We have a Kristang Dragon dropship that could be added to the fight. No, most Kristang dropships don't have enough technological advantage over the Wargalan to make me comfortable about using them in combat. It's my job to worry, Skippy. I'm captain of the ship. What do you know about the space station near the fourth planet? This is awkward calling it fourth planet. It's like Mars, so we'll call it a Barsoom. Any objections? I picked the name from some old sci-fi novels I read as a kid. No? Good. The space station is very close to where I expected it. No issues there. Very close. It's just coasting along in orbit. Why isn't it exactly where you expected? Skippy sighed like an elementary school teacher explaining something over and over to the dumbest kid in the class. Because, Joe, almost nothing in space is ever exactly static. An orbiting station vents atmosphere, either from leaks or from airlocks and docking bays opening. Solar wind particles push on it unevenly. Launching and recovering dropships pushes the station around. Even personnel walking inside the station make it wobble as their feet push on the floor and their mass shifts from one location to another. All objects in orbit need to perform regular station-keeping adjustments, and the station is only 80 freaking meters from where I expected it to be based on data that is 2 years old. You big jerk.
I got the message, Skippy. Colonel Chang, pull the senior leaders together in 10 minutes and we'll make a go-no-go decision on the op.
The decision was go. We spent 2 hours maneuvering the ship in normal space to get it pointed in exactly the right direction and traveling at the exact speed required. Teams got into their dropships. We purged the docking bays of air and slid the doors open. The dropships ran their engines up, and everyone involved double-checked things they had already triple-checked. Part of the reason we were not in a hurry was that Skippy had learned there was a briefing by a high-ranking official visiting the main airbase on Barsoom, so we expected few of their birds would be in the air at that time. Pilots forced to listen to a boring speech might be just a bit slower to rush toward their aircraft during an alert, allowing us precious seconds to destroy those dropships while still in their hangars. We hoped. Finally, I gave the order to jump, and the generic starfield outside was instantly replaced by a starfield with a red dot the size of a ping-pong ball that was the planet Barsoom. Ships come out of a jump almost blind, and the Dutchman was no exception to that rule, especially now that Skippy no longer had many of his special abilities. To disable the space station, we had to hit it in the right places, and to do that, we needed two things. First, to know exactly where the space station was located, and because we couldn't afford for that info to be hours old, we jumped in only 8 light minutes away on the far side of Barsoom, where our gamma ray burst would not be seen from the third planet. The second thing we needed was for our final jump to be short, making it easy for Skippy to be extra super-duper accurate about where we emerged from the next jump. Our targeting sensors would still be resetting after the next jump, so Skippy had to pre-program precise firing solutions into our targeting computers before the jump. Our weapons simply had to follow instructions. Skippy got an exact fix on the space station's location, and as soon as our overworked drive coils were ready, we jumped again to launch the assault. The reddish orb of Barsoom loomed large on the main display, and something zoomed past on the screen faster than my eyes could follow. Fortunately, Skippy's firing solutions were deadly accurate, and we nailed the space station's defense shield projectors with 3 maser blasts before our ship zipped past. Missiles that were ready to go before our jump rocketed out of their launch tubes and impacted the surprised and now defenseless station, tearing into its central hub and causing it to break apart, sending the rotating arms flying off into space. Less than 8 seconds after the Flying Dutchman emerged from jump, the space station was no longer a threat to us, and no longer capable of providing cover for the planet below. The planet. It was growing fast, too fast in the display. "All dropships away," Chang announced in the CIC as my heart was in my throat from seeing the dusty red soil of Barsoom approaching way too fast. I mean, if I lived down there, I could see my house. We appeared to be that close. "Mesa's firing at surface targets. Second volley of missiles are away. We are clear." As I opened my mouth to shout a panicked order, Desai executed pre-planned instructions and we jumped for a third time. This time, we emerged behind our prior course as if we'd gone back in time. The ship was still racing toward the planet, but this time the planet was further away, and we were not in immediate danger of crashing into Barsoom. "Skippy?" I asked. Anticipating my question, he answered. "Jump drive is in acceptable condition, however, we will not be able to jump again for another 9 minutes. Jumping not recommended for at least 13 minutes. The space station is disabled, and our maser cannons knocked out shield generators at the airbase." That was good shooting, even if I am praising myself. "Our missiles will be impacting in 3, 2, 1, impact. Assessing battle damage now. Secondary explosions." Wow, that was a big one. We must have hit an ammo dump or fuel storage tanks. One intelligence item Skippy had not been able to obtain had been a detailed schematic of the main airbase on Barsoom. Apparently it was under constant construction, and the Wergalin were not good at updating their files in a timely manner. Due to the lack of data, Skippy had been forced to guess which targets to hit while we were still outside the star system. "Picking up alarms now?" "Yep. The Octopussies are scrambling to launch all available aircraft, which I think is going to be a lot less now that our missiles ransacked that base." Okay. There is a formation of 4 dropships that were already in the air on a training flight. The good news is they are not carrying a missile load, so they only have masers to shoot with, and they are low on fuel. The bad news is they are within 60 kilometers of our target, and their leader has told her fellow pilots she intends to crash into our ships if that is necessary to stop us. And more aircraft are launching now. Some of their aircraft were in hardened underground shelters. Uh-oh. It looks like there are a lot of those underground shelters. They can't all have aircraft in them. Damn it! Those shelters weren't on the current schematic of the airbase. We can't afford to expend any more anti-ship missiles now, I declared unhappily. Can we target those shelters with our maser cannons? Hit the ones that have not yet launched aircraft?
Joe, many of those shelters may be empty. Hitting them would be like playing whack-a-mole by trying to hit all the holes. And our mazes are not powerful enough to punch down through that hardened material to hit the shelters. No, I agreed. But if we keep up a constant fire on those shelters, aircraft will have to stay in there. They won't be able to launch.
Oh. Skippy's voice was chastened.
Duh. I should have thought of that. Targeting solutions are loaded into fire control computers now. Colonel Chang, let's make the Wagallan keep their heads down, I ordered.
With pleasure, sir, he replied, and turned his attention to the people at the weapon stations in CIC.
Joe, I have to caution you, Skippy added. While we are firing mazes, we are still able to maintain stealth, so the Wagallan will not discover what type of ship this is, but they will get a lock on our position.
Understood, Skippy. We will take that. The ship rocked slightly.
That was a near miss by a mazer cannon on the surface, Skippy warned. No damage to the ship. Enemy has launched missiles at us. 7 missiles inbound.
I knew we had an advantage from being at the top of the planet's gravity well, and the missiles' wildly hot boost phase exhaust was giving away their positions.
Any way we can hit those missiles from here? Thin out their numbers?
That would be a waste of time from here, Skippy advised. By the time our mazer bolts reach them, the missiles will have maneuvered out of the way. I believe our point defense systems can cope with 7 missiles of Wagallan-level technology. But, Joe, we will need to pause our mazer bombardment of the surface.
All right. I clenched my fists. Chang, continue hitting those aircraft shelters until Skippy instructs you to break off. I don't like leaving our dropships to fight by themselves.
Raptors, this is Raptor Lead, Samantha Fireball Reed heard in her headset. Dutchman needs to break off their attack to deal with vampires. It's up to us now.
The Combat Air Patrol leader used the American Standard Brevity Code Vampire to designate a hostile anti-ship missile, in this case, alien anti-ship missiles attacking their star carrier, the pirate ship that was their only ride home. Sammy's hand clenched when she heard the Dutchman was under attack. Then she forced her hand to relax so she could control her Falcon dropship. There wasn't anything she could do to directly help the Dutchman. What she could do was perform her own assigned task quickly and efficiently so the mission could be completed and the Dutchman could jump away to safety. Or to comparative safety in a galaxy that was entirely hostile to a ship full of pirate humans.
Raptor 2, the flight leader called Sammy. There are 4 bandits southwest of us at Angels 31. You are cleared hot to engage. Be advised, Skippy says those 4 bandits do not, repeat, do not have missiles. So any birds in the air will be yours.
Roger that, Sammy acknowledged with a tight smile.
Fireball, the leader said. Splash those bandits if you have to, but the priority is to keep them away from the Condors.
Understood.
This time Sammy's smile inside the visor of her helmet was broader. She saw the 4 enemy aircraft on her display. They were maintaining a tight formation and gaining speed and altitude rapidly, closing the distance to her even before she turned. With a flick of the little finger on her left hand, she designated the 4 bandits as hostile and locked targeting sensors on them.
Fireball is engaged?
With another finger, she throttled up her engines, snapping her expression to a frown as the turbines spooled up only part way. Before the mission, Skippy had loaded revised software into all 6 Thuranan dropships so they would perform as if they were Kristang craft. In an emergency, there was a red button Sammy could press to override the new software and restore the flight control system to its nominal Thuranan specs for full performance. But that would need to be an extreme emergency indeed. Until then, the Falcon was limited to performing like a Kristang Dragon dropship, which Sammy had to remind herself could blow away the hottest combat aircraft on Earth. With her Falcon accelerating downward toward the 4 enemy aircraft, the distance was closing rapidly. Sammy knew her duty was not to be a hotshot glory hog. She also knew the surest way to keep those 4 Wagallan fighters away from the vulnerable Condors was if those Wagallan craft were hot pieces of shrapnel raining over the dusty red surface of Barsoom.
1 missile each, she advised her co-pilot. Let's not waste ordnance until we know what these octopussies can do.
Unlike the dropships, their Thuranan air-to-air missiles were not restricted to operating as if they were Kristang weapons.
The thought was that in the heat and confusion of battle, no one had time to notice missiles flying slightly faster or more accurately than expected.
"Roger that. We are now within the engagement envelope," Sammy's co-pilot Wu acknowledged.
"Birds affirm," she announced as all four missiles synced with the Falcon's fire control system and acquired their assigned targets. "Birds away, Ripple," she stated as the Falcon rocked slightly, adjusting automatically as four missiles were ejected simultaneously. On the wraparound display that substituted for cockpit windows, Sammy could see four bright flashes, then four wispy white contrails. Immediately, she reduced power and turned to the right.
"Switch to guns," she ordered. "I'm putting us between the bandits and the condors."
On the display, she saw the four bandits breaking formation and splitting apart in reaction to the incoming missiles, and she saw her missiles streaking after the enemy. A Falcon carried 16 multi-purpose missiles. 16 seemed like a lot when Sammy had been used to a fighter carrying four or six missiles in the U.S. Air Force, but with alien aircraft possessing defensive maser beams that could intercept missiles, in a worst-case scenario she may need all 16 just to kill four Wirgalan fighters. The distant flashes of their Star Carrier's maser cannon pummeling the airbase had stopped, and Sammy could see more enemy aircraft launching from the airbase at the edge of her sensor coverage. Two of the Falcons had moved to intercept, while Raptor 3 was flying cover close to the pair of descending Condors.
"This could turn into one hell of a furball," she murmured worriedly. "Let's hope the ground pounders get this over with ASAP."
The lead ground pounder would have heartily agreed with Sammy's sentiment as he braced himself with his knees in the Condor, which had completed its non-stealthy and fiery entry to Barsoom's thin atmosphere. Over the cockpit channel, Major Smythe could hear the two pilots tersely discussing how the dropship's shields had been strained by protecting the Condor's leading edges and belly from superheated plasma created by the falling craft burning a hole down through the air. As the pilots were not yet worried about the condition of the shields or any other onboard system, he mentally tuned them out and concentrated on understanding the tactical situation. The six dropships had launched from the Flying Dutchman just above the upper edge of the atmosphere and had scorched their way downward on a minimum time-to-target flight profile. With only 30 minutes for the entire operation, they could not waste time getting down to the surface, so stealth had been thrown out the window, along with any attempt to conceal their objective. The two Condors had flown directly at the objective, with the four Falcons flying cover between the objective and that main airbase. Smythe had been in bad helicopter rides during his time in the military, when he had prayed for the aircraft to stop bouncing up and down in a vicious storm. The ride down to the surface of Barsoom was worse. The Condor, a remarkable piece of advanced Theranan engineering, had bounced and rocked and rattled until Smythe thought it would shake itself and him apart. Even with sophisticated systems to compensate for external forces and protect the occupants from being crushed during the 6G descent, Smythe had found it hard to breathe, as if an elephant was sitting on his chest. Now that the descent was over and the Condor was racing at low altitude toward the objective, Smythe pulled up the tactical display in his helmet's visor and was almost shocked to see that so far everything was proceeding according to plan.
"Executing pop-up in 3, 2, 1, now," the pilot advised, and Smythe was first pressed down into his seat, then briefly experienced zero gravity at the top of the arc as the Condor and its twin leapt up to gain altitude and a line of sight to the objective. Their objective was part of an elder facility that had been discovered in ancient times by the Maxalks, who had also long ago removed everything they thought might be useful or interesting. The Maxalks had no interest in the star system that was far from any active wormhole, so the planets there had remained uninhabited until a wormhole shift made the system more accessible. The first species to stake a claim had been the Kristang, but because of a long-standing dispute between the Kristang's patrons the Theranan and the Wirgalan's patrons the Bosphorok, the Kristang had been encouraged to give the system to the Wirgalan. As this encouragement was delivered in the form of orbital bombardment by a trio of Bosphorok battleships, the Kristang were quickly persuaded of the strength of argument in favor of the Wirgalan. Since the time Wirgalan took up residence in a star system which had nothing special going for it,
They had also taken possession of the Elder Site on the fourth planet, which they had absolutely no idea what to do with. The site had been fairly stripped by the Maxulks, so even though the Wargalan were desperate to gain a technological advantage over their hated rivals the Kristang, they could not find anything useful among the Elder artifacts. Not wanting to appear ungrateful that their patrons had given the star system to them, the Wargalan constructed a dome over the Elder Site, and then, as years and then centuries passed, without anyone knowing what to do with the site, they mostly forgot about it. The remaining Elder objects under the dome became curiosities, with rare VIPs who bothered to visit the fourth planet occasionally being offered a tour. Every 4 or 5 centuries, a Wargalan scientist requested to examine the Elder equipment, and when no new knowledge or insight was gained, the dome went back into its peaceful slumber. "The objective looks abandoned, just as Skippy said," Smythe noted with satisfaction as his helmet visor displayed images from the Condor's nose camera. A layer of red dust coated the dome, piling up thick around the ribs and thinner toward the middle of the glass sections. The actual dome was long neglected. However, the underground military base that had originally been established to provide security for the dome was still active, as evidenced by the presence of 2 transport aircraft parked on their landing pads. Smythe could see miniature pink dust devils swirling across the pads as those aircraft spun up their turbines for takeoff. "Can you knock out those transports?" "Affirmative," the Condor's lead pilot responded tightly, and as Smythe watched, the Condor's maser cannons ripped into the nearly defenseless aircraft, slicing off the tail of one as it tilted toward the sky to lift off. It crashed back to the ground, wobbling a bit as the pilots attempted to regain control. Then both aircraft became flares of light on the display when a pair of missiles from the Condor obliterated them. "Good shooting," Smythe said emotionlessly, his attention already elsewhere. Skippy had learned from schematics that tunnels connected the military base to the dome, so if enemy soldiers were pouring out of the ground into the dome, he had no way of knowing at the moment. No matter. They would stick to the plan which had worked well so far. "Execute break-in." He used the term for the preferred option of gaining quick access to the interior of the dome. Quick was the key. Once his team reached the ground, they had only 7 minutes to locate, secure, and retrieve their objective before the Condors were scheduled to return to the Flying Dutchman. "Execute break-in. Roger that," the pilot acknowledged. A maser cannon under the chin of each Condor fired, not in a searing destructive burst, but in a sustained surgical beam that carved neat holes in the glass of the dome. The material was not actually glass, Smythe knew, and it did not shatter. The edges of the near-circular holes were glowing orange where the maser beam had cut through, and Smythe could see the dome material was thicker than expected. The extra thickness had not been a problem, as the fire control system controlling the maser cannon had simply increased power and duration based on sensor feedback. "We have access," the pilot stated needlessly, as everyone aboard the Condor was watching the nose camera feed in their helmet visors. "Bringing us into hover. Let's be quick about it." Of the 4 Wargalan fighters Lieutenant Reed had engaged, 2 fell victim to missiles she ripple-fired in her first volley. One of the missiles that missed its first target had circled around and re-engaged another Wargalan craft, forcing it to desperately maneuver away and taking it out of the immediate fight. The last enemy fighter had been lucky. Its defensive maser had clipped one of Sammy's missiles and sent it cartwheeling across the sky to self-destruct uselessly. After launching her first 4 missiles, Sammy had broken away from a direct course toward the enemy, as her Theranan air-to-air missiles had not needed any guidance or control from their launching ship. Her greater altitude and airspeed allowed her to dictate the terms of the air battle. She could engage, break away, and re-engage at will, while the enemy could only react to her moves. For almost a full minute, the 2 dropships tangled across the sky, their maser cannons spitting beams of microwave energy when their computers thought they had a good firing solution. Both ships were hit without significant effect, the glancing maser bolts being deflected and absorbed by defense shields. Then the Wargalan ship that was being chased by Sammy's last missile lost its battle, as the missile scored a direct hit and turned it into a ball of sooty plasma. Seeing it was now truly alone, The remaining enemy fighter broke away from the engagement with Sammy, turning to fly at full power toward the two descending condors. Sammy reacted immediately, toggling off one of her precious 12 missiles at the enemy and hooking her Falcon hard around in a nearly 180-degree turn. The abrupt maneuver bled off airspeed energy and was almost the last thing she was supposed to do in air combat, but it could not be helped. Before the enemy changed course, she had been leading it away from the pair of condors, and now she found herself badly out of position. The condors were especially vulnerable at the moment. She could see on her display the large Theranan dropships were popping up as they performed their final approach to the dome. One Falcon was between the Wirgalan fighter and the condors, but that Falcon had troubles of its own, as a pair of enemy aircraft were approaching from the south. And Sammy herself had another problem about to go from imminent to active. Three enemy fighters coming straight at her from the airbase. Raptor Lead and his wingman were already fully engaged in a swirling furball with eight Wirgalan, so she could not expect help from them.
Oh, hell, she said to herself. Four against one again.
The large Theranan dropship called a Condor by humans was not designed to insert special operations troops. It was simply a transport that was most often used for cargo. The merry band of pirates had improvised with help from Skippy, and as the Condor slowed to a halt in mid-air above one of the 20-meter diameter holes in the dome, the back ramp dropped open quickly, and Smythe jumped out with his team. No sooner had the last pirate cleared the ramp than the pilot increased power to take the big and vulnerable Condor out of hover to go streaking away a mere 100 meters off the surface. The second Condor disgorged its troops seconds later and followed the lead ship away while Smythe's team was still falling through the thin air. The air of Barsoom was thin, mostly blown away by the solar wind eons ago. To slow and control the descent of a single armor-suited pirate would have required an enormous parachute or balloon, too large to be deployed with two teams of eight dropping in formation through holes a mere 20 meters across. Instead of parachutes or balloons, each person in a Krestang-powered armor suit was suspended beneath a jet-powered drone. The drones at first descended with their precious cargo, acting only to slow the descent. Then, each drone increased power to hover as they passed over the hole. With the drone momentarily stationary, the tether holding the troopers stretched to lower the person safely through the hole and to within 3 meters of the interior floor, at which point the tether released from the trooper's harness. In the blink of an eye, the tether retracted into its drone, and the drone zipped away to be replaced by the next drone in formation. Smythe was the fourth person to drop through the breach dome, and as the tether lowered him quickly, he saw movement on the far side of the dome. Octopussies. Two of them. The Wirgalan were referred to as octopussies by humans, just as humans had nicknamed the Ruhar hamsters and the Krestang lizards. The Wirgalan were not octopi any more than the Krestang were lizards, but military tradition demanded enemies to be given a derisive name, so octopussies was an obvious and universally accepted choice. In truth, although the Wirgalan did appear a bit like large land-dwelling octopi, they had only 7 legs, not 8, and so one of them might more accurately be called a septopus. Although, in addition to their 7 combination arm legs, they had a prehensile tentacle on their foreheads, so octopus was close enough. 7 legs gave a Wirgalan a lot to keep track of when moving around, and many options for locomotion. Their fastest gait was to use their 2 front arm legs together, stretching them out in front and then flinging them under their bodies as they ran. To each side, pairs of arm legs could be used together, or only 1 arm leg on each side if the Wirgalan were carrying something like a weapon. The 7th arm leg in the back was held out to the back as a sort of tail for balance when moving at high speed. Smythe considered that formation in a flash as he dropped down through the opening in the shattered dome and saw movement at the corner of his vision. In addition to providing a physical description of the Wirgalan, focusing on relevant characteristics, capabilities, and weaknesses, Skippy had given his opinion of Wirgalan culture. If you think the Krestang and Theranan are awful MFers, then you will really hate the Wirgalan. As the Krestang had considered humans to be a disgustingly useless low-tech client species, The Wirgalin had a client species of their own, the Urgar. With Wirgalin technology still measurably behind that of the rival Kristang, one might wonder why the Wirgalin deserved, needed, or would bother with a client species of their own. That question was almost moot, as under the not-tender guidance of the Wirgalin, the Urgar had become almost extinct. The last few million Urgar living out a miserable existence on a harsh colony planet after the Wirgalin had taken their home world would welcome the cruel Kristang as saviors if they had the option, an option the Urgar were unlikely to ever enjoy. As Smythe completed his split-second recollection of everything relevant he knew about the Wirgalin, he swung his rifle around and fixed the targeting crosshairs in the visor of his Kristang armored suit at the Wirgalin on the right, just as the creature was bringing its own weapon to bear on Smythe. Before Smythe could squeeze the trigger, the Wirgalin and its companion were blown backwards in a hail of explosive-tipped rounds. The pirates who came through the opening in the dome before Smythe saw the threat before he did, and they dealt with the Wirgalin quickly and efficiently. The rounds impacting the octopussies not only exploded, they penetrated the suits before exploding, blowing chunks of alien in all directions. "Their suits aren't armored," Smythe observed over the open channel as he scanned the dome, spinning around 360 on the tether and not seeing any other threats. Operation of the tether was fully automatic unless he took manual control in an emergency. When the tether controller saw, through sensors on the bottom of his boots, that Smythe was less than a meter from the surface, the tether released itself from his harness and he dropped lightly to the hard, smooth surface. Concrete, or something like that, he observed in the back of his mind. Concrete, hard and smooth, but not slippery. And he realized it was not entirely smooth. It was spiderwebbed with small cracks, and there was a fine layer of pink dust covering everything, including the elder artifact that dominated the center of the dome. The facility was, as Skippy had assured the pirates, neglected by the Wirgalin. There was a military outpost attached to the dome, but it was generally staffed by only a half dozen octopussies as a sort of honor guard, whose main function was to escort the occasionally important visitor. That explained the lack of armor on the suits of the two now-dead Wirgalin. They had likely donned whatever gear they had available on short notice when the pirate dropships were observed screaming down from orbit directly at the dome. In his powered suit and the low gravity, Smythe crossed the dome within seconds to stand over the dead octopussies. Thick purple blood was oozing slowly from the bodies, simultaneously freezing and boiling in the cold and low atmospheric pressure now that the dome had been breached. Smythe could see the enemy soldiers had come into the dome from a stairway set into the floor. Two other stairways were set at 120 degrees apart. Teams were already poised near all three stairways, and at Smythe's order, a pair of grenades were dropped into each stairway. One grenade of each pair was set for concussion effect, the other for an intense thermal burn. With all the pirates laying flat, the grenades coordinated over the tack link between the suits and exploded in series. Concussives first, followed by thermal a split second later. The floor of the dome rocked, and more cracks appeared in the surface. Near the holes where the dome had been breached, the translucent material cracked and fell in to crash onto the floor, creating wider gaps in the dome. The breaching holes had been cut near the edges of the dome to avoid the masers hitting the elder artifact in the center. Skippy had assured Smythe that mere grenades would not collapse the main structure of the dome onto the artifact. The instant the burning gouts of flame from the stairwells had subsided, teams, including Smythe, were racing toward the artifact.
"This is different, Major," Ranger Mihalchik observed unhappily.
In preparing for the mission, the team had studied 3D images provided by Skippy based on whatever data he had been able to collect from the edge of the star system. Clearly, the images Skippy had access to were incomplete or out of date. Parts of the artifact were missing, and new, unknown parts were attached to it.
"It is," Smythe replied calmly. "The Wirgalin may have removed pieces for study, then reinstalled them. The piece we need is in there."
He pointed up and to the center of what looked like a modern art sculpture combined with an oil rig.
"Cutters, clear these two pieces away."
He forced himself to be calm as the counter in the corner of his visor indicated they were already behind schedule. Four people equipped with plasma torches lost no time in firing up their cutters at full intensity, flooding the dome with harsh light and causing everyone's visors to automatically darken, which is why the Wargalin were able to surprise them. Wargalin were not stupid, and although the soldiers assigned to the honor guard at the dome were very much out of practice at combat, they knew to keep away from the three stairwells after the airlock doors there had been shattered and incinerated, along with two unlucky soldiers who had been about to open a door and charge up the stairs. The remaining two Wargalin, in their lightweight ceremonial armor, knew their duty was to protect the precious Elder artifact from what the surveillance cameras showed was a Kristang raiding party. If the dome had been equipped with maser cannons on the interior, the Wargalin would have activated them. If the honor guard had been equipped with hunter-killer drones, they would have used those. If their rifles had been supplied with armor-piercing or explosive-tipped rounds, they would have used those. Because Wargalin leadership was concerned about potential damage to the artifact more than the extremely unlikely possibility of an assault on the dome, all the honor guard had for weapons were rifles with low-velocity rounds. Any attack on the star system would logically begin with strikes on the populated third planet, then with an orbital bombardment and ground assault on the airbase of the fourth planet. Only when Wargalin forces had been defeated across the star system, the strategic defense plan anticipated, would an enemy turn their attention to the useless curiosity of the Elder artifact under the dome. A raid focused on the artifact had never been considered in the defense plan. The remaining two Wargalin emerged into the dome through an access hatch concealed in the floor under part of the original artifact that had long ago been taken away. Smythe's first indication that anything was amiss occurred when a pirate applying a plasma torch to the artifact had the torch knocked out of his hands to go spinning along the floor. The torch cut out when the trigger was released, which saved the user from having his legs severed by the torch. His armored suit sustained no more than dents under the impact of the low-velocity rounds, even though both Wargalin concentrated their rifles on one pirate. "Do not hit the artifact!" Smythe shouted as his team turned their attention to the multi-legged adversaries under the Elder device. When Smythe first learned the Wargalin were structurally similar to an octopus, he had been concerned about an enemy who could stand on 2 feet and theoretically hold 5 weapons. Skippy had scoffed at that foolish notion, explaining that was no more likely than a 2-armed human simultaneously controlling 2 rifles. The brain of a Wargalin could only track 1 target at a time, and having to control 7 limbs plus a prehensile antenna actually was a burden on a Wargalin brain's processing speed. Attempts over the centuries to genetically enhance their thinking speed had run into the immovable obstacle of their basic brain architecture. Limitations of Wargalin physiology mattered, because despite their reaction speed and eye tentacle accuracy, was not hugely better than the elite merry band of pirates. Without Major Smythe having to explain further, 4 pirates flicked switches on their rifles to deactivate the explosive tips of their rounds and select a high-impact mode that caused the round to mushroom on contact. While the 2 octopuses were still firing, they were hit by over 3 dozen Kristang rounds. The light ceremonial armor surprisingly protected them, but the kinetic energy of the rounds lifted the 2 aliens and flung them to go skittering across the floor. Across the floor and out from under the protection of the artifact. Again, no orders were needed as the 4 pirates on cover detail flicked switches again. The rounds that followed the change of mode had their penetration and explosive ability restored. In an instant, the 2 brave but hapless octopuses were sent to whatever afterlife they believed in.
"Clear," Captain Chandra shouted calmly. "Sweep the floor for more of these damned concealed hatches."
"Chan," Smythe asked the stricken pirate who had already gotten back on his feet and retrieved the plasma torch.
"Are you all right?"
"Yes, Major," Chan replied as he handed the torch to another soldier. Chan felt mostly able to return to duty. He also knew that was not the way the merry band of pirates operated. His armored suit may have undiscovered damage that might slow him down, and the raiding party could not afford any delays, so while Mahalchik took the plasma torch and got to work with it, Chan unslung his rifle and replaced the ranger on cover duty. The plasma torches quickly cut through the surrounding structure, exposing the section Skippy wanted the pirates to bring back.
As the interfering sections clattered to the floor and pirates leaped out of the way, Smythe hopped up onto the dais to examine the conduit, or whatever it was.
"Skippy didn't tell us to expect all this extra equipment attached to it," he stated flatly with concern.
The actual conduit was slightly over 2 meters long and easily carried by one person in a powered suit and low gravity. With all the potentially important equipment attached, it was large and bulky enough to require 2 people to transport it.
"Cut it away at the base here," Smythe made a snap decision. "Sappers, blow the dome wall. We're going out that way."
He eye-clicked through a menu inside his visor, blinking to select secure communications mode and send a message to the waiting condors that his team would require a ground extraction without the tethers of the original plan. The team worked quickly and efficiently. 2 soldiers carried the conduit out a hole blasted in the dome's sidewall, covered by the others. As Smythe stepped out of the dome onto the dusty surface of Barsoom, a glance at the clock in the corner of his visor almost drew a smile. 2 minutes, 34 seconds remaining. They were actually ahead of schedule. Part of the extra time would be eaten up by the condors landing and loading the bulky Elder conduit aboard, but that possibility had been baked into the schedule. Now all Smythe needed were the condors. Where the hell were they?
"This is interesting," Sammy said quietly as her full concentration was used on the unfamiliar and, to her knowledge, unprecedented maneuver she was flying. In the U.S. Air Force, she had been trained to use the terms weeds, low, medium, high, and very high to describe target altitudes ranging anywhere from scraping treetops to above 40,000 feet. Because those terms were utterly meaningless in airspace combat, pilots serving with the Merry Band of Pirates had come up with their own terminology. Dust, air, thin, orbit, and beyond, with thin being anywhere technically still within an atmosphere, but high enough that aerodynamic controls were inoperative in the thin air. When Lieutenant Samantha Reed thought of the term dust, she used to consider that to mean flying close to the surface of any world, whether it had an atmosphere or not, and whether the surface below was dust, trees, or water. With the surface of Barsoom consisting of fine red dust, grainy pebbles of red sand, and dust-coated rocks, the term dust was entirely appropriate. On Barsoom, the combination of dust and an atmosphere caused trouble for Sammy, because it limited her options. When the lone Wargallan fighter had, to Sammy's relief, been destroyed by one of her missiles before the enemy got within range to fire masers at the pair of condors, she had switched her attention to the 3 enemy dropships racing in from the airbase. The condors had dropped off Major Smythe's team and were free to maneuver defensively for a few minutes, so they were proceeding directly away at high speed while calling out a warning that they needed to return to the dome very soon. In a chaotic yet brief air battle, Sammy had destroyed one of the 3 enemy with a missile, then, to her surprise, had shot down a second with a snapshot maser cannon blast. That had been a momentarily satisfying victory Sammy had not been able to acknowledge with even a smile, before her co-pilot warned their own defensive shield and stealth field had been seriously degraded during the encounter, as the shields had deflected multiple maser bolts and 2 exploding warheads of near-miss enemy missiles. The shield emitters needed over a minute to recharge before they could protect Sammy's Falcon from even a single maser bolt shot by the 2 Wargallan fighters hunting her, as another lone enemy aircraft had joined the fight. With her shields weakened and stealth compromised, Sammy had considered her options in a flash. Streaking along close to the deck was no good. The turbulence of her high-speed passage through even the thin atmosphere would stir up dust on the ground below like a fingernail scraping the red soil, leaving reddish clouds pointing the enemy directly at her. What she decided to do, she considered as she allowed herself a tight smile, was worthy of a Bishop Award for craziest idea dreamed up out of nothing. The air of Barsoom, while thin, was still sufficiently dense to stir up the surface dust when winds blew hard. Dust storms on the planet could spring up and disappear quickly, or they could last for days and build so strong they created dust devils, the local equivalent of tornadoes. Sammy was hovering her Falcon inside the tightly swirling cone of a dust devil, while outside, the pair of Wargallan fighters grew increasingly frustrated trying to find her. To the Wargallan,
The Falcon they were chasing dove to the deck, then behind a ridge. But when the Wirgalan craft followed, their enemy was nowhere to be seen.
"They won't orbit this area forever," Sammy said unnecessarily to her co-pilot, who could see the situation on her own display.
"No, they won't. 42 seconds to recharge shield emitters," Wu added, knowing that information was on the display in front of Sammy, but that the pilot was busy keeping their Falcon inside the rapidly changing Dust Devil. A moment before, Wu had feared the Dust Devil would dissipate. Then it found new strength and must have flown over an area of particularly fine dust particles because the air outside was instantly obscured to a pink haze.
"Turbines are heating up," she warned. "This dust may be melting onto the fan blades."
That was a problem they had limited ability to deal with. Polarizing the fan blades to repel dust might be detected by enemy sensors.
"We'll deal with it," she decided, considering they would only remain inside the Dust Devil until their shields were fully recovered.
"Where are the bandits?" Sammy asked.
"Still no joy on the passive gear," Wu said tersely. "We're picking up intermittent blips from their tack-link signals, but not strong enough to get a firing solution on their location. They're still searching for us."
With the enemy dropships in stealth, and the Falcon's sensors obscured by the magnetically charged dust surrounding them, they could not detect the enemy's presence other than through brief backscatter of signals the Wirgalan shared with each other over their tactical data link.
"We can't launch without—"
Her problem was solved by the enemy's impatience. The Falcon's threat console lit up as the Theranan dropship was swept by an active sensor pulse.
87, Wu warned, indicating that enemy sensor pulse was 87% of the power needed to pinpoint the Falcon's location.
While the enemy's initial sensor pulse was 13% too weak to give away the Falcon's position, it was 1,000,000% stronger than Wu needed to determine exactly where the transmitting aircraft was.
"Tracking one," she announced. "Solid lock."
Sammy glanced away from the cockpit navigation display to check the condition of the shield emitters. They still had 12 seconds remaining until they regained full capacity.
"Close enough," Sammy decided.
Plus, the Condors had turned and were on their way back to the dome to retrieve Major Smythe's team. It was time to stop delaying and distracting the enemy and start killing them.
"Launch two birds at that bandit," she ordered, not needing to specify whether to fire heat-seeking or radar-guided missiles, as the deadly Theranan weapons were multi-purpose killers, capable of homing in on a target using active and passive sensors covering the entire electromagnetic spectrum.
"Birds affirm," Wu confirmed, targeting sensors had a lock on the enemy's location, and the two missiles had received the data, birds away.
"Here we go."
Sammy advanced the throttles and stood the Falcon on its tail, flying straight up and quickly clearing the Dust Devil. Enemy sensor pulses were now both fully able to detect the Falcon and fully unnecessary, because the energy radiating from the Theranan craft's engines left a thermal trail its stealth field could not conceal.
Switching to guns.
The Condors came in low and fast over a ridge to the north. Smythe had been tracking them in his helmet visor through the encrypted tactical data link, but seeing them was still startling. One moment, the horizon was clear, and the next moment, two large shapes loomed in front of him. With both airspace craft in stealth, Smythe knew his helmet was filling in the image for him. Without visual enhancement, all he would have seen is a very faint ripple of dust particles in the thin air.
"The pilots were showing off," Smythe thought, as one side of his mouth curled up in an admiring smile.
He couldn't fault the pilots for wishing to arrive in style. As the Condors cleared the ridge, they flared in a synchronized maneuver, main turbines howling in reverse and thruster jets on belly and nose firing to slow the craft for landing. At the last second, as it appeared the two big dropships would fulfill their names and drop to cash into the red-gray dusty ground, they straightened out and made a final correction for landing, setting down exactly on the markers laid down by Smythe's team.
"Hurry," the lead pilot urged. "Multiple bandits inbound."
Perhaps the pilots had not been showing off after all, Smythe reflected as he waited impatiently for the rear ramp to open. Knowing the ground team would be anxious to get aboard, both ships had cracked their ramps open as they flared for landing,
and the crew chiefs used the emergency procedure of allowing the big ramps to slam down against their stops rather than the leisurely process of cycling them down used for cargo loading. Smythe and his team chafed at the delay anyway. It pleased Smythe that no one broke procedure by rushing up the ramp until the crew chiefs reported they were fully down and locked. First aboard were the two soldiers carrying the precious but awkward-to-handle Elder conduit device, while everyone else had their rifles ready to provide cover. Both Condors had their chin and side maser turrets pointed at the dome, prepared to rain blistering hellfire on anyone who threatened the band of pirates. No threat emerged, Smythe saw with great satisfaction, and if he were completely honest with himself, a tiny bit of disappointment. He was last aboard. No sooner were his boots halfway up the ramp, racing forward in the hastened pace of powered armor, when the ramp began cycling closed, and he felt the big Condor lift off. That rapid dust-off maneuver was reserved for combat emergencies because of the danger it posed to unsecured personnel. As Smythe raced forward and was caught by the restraining net, he knew the danger was less than it seemed. His Krestang suit would stabilize his movement and prevent him from falling out the sides of the half-open ramp, and the pilots took off in a nose-down position. The worst that could have happened to Smythe was bruising his dignity, and he cared nothing about that.
"Clear!" he shouted as the nanofiber netting held him securely upright.
Just in time. The pilot stood the big Theranan dropship on its tail and fired the main jets hard, surging for the safety of orbit. Sammy's fingers moved to turn the Falcon to deal with a new threat. Then she heard a voice in her earpiece just as Wu launched another missile.
"This is Raptor Lead. All ships, knock it off. Repeat, knock it off," he issued the order to disengage from air combat. "Bingo to home plate." Then he added, "Good shooting, people."
Sammy's reaction was to pull backward on the touchscreen controls with one finger, pulling the Falcon's nose up, and the flick of another finger advanced the throttles. "Oops," she shot a guilty smile at her co-pilot.
"Raptor Lead, we have a bird in the air. Should we abort?"
The reply was delayed for a moment while the lead pilot checked his own display. Sammy hoped he noticed that she had launched the missile before he gave the order to disengage.
"That's a negative fireball. We could use the cover. All ships, conserve your missiles. We never know when we'll need them."
Wu grinned and gave Sammy a thumbs up as the pilot pushed the dropship to full power, and it climbed toward their precisely scheduled rendezvous with home plate, their star carrier. Both women kept one eye on the display, tracking the lone missile as it pursued the limping enemy aircraft. The Wargalan dropship dove for the deck. Then the alien pilots must have realized they had no chance to escape, for the dropship's nose pulled up, and two crew ejected. The ejection seats carried the octopussies up and away. The Theranan missile bored in toward the easy target of the unguided dropship, punching halfway through before exploding.
"Congrats, people. I believe that is a grand slam," Raptor Lead said with satisfaction.
All hostile aircraft engaged had been destroyed, with only minor damage to the pirate ships. Perhaps it had never been a fair fight, pitting Theranan technology against the Wargalan and highly trained, determined, and focused pirates against bored alien garrison pilots. Yet it was the first time the merry band of pirates had been in air-to-air combat, and they had triumphed. Raptor Lead smiled broadly as he added,
"Monkeys kicked ass today."
The ass-kicking was not exactly complete when the six dropships cleared the atmosphere. They still had to rendezvous with and be taken aboard the star carrier, which was nowhere in sight and completely out of communications range. While that was not unexpected because it was part of the plan, it was unnerving. After soaring above the last wisps of Barsoom's thin atmosphere, the two Condors went to full power, with the smaller and more nimble Falcons throttling back, hanging behind to protect against any last-minute enemy attempts to intercept. In formation, they raced straight away from the planet, aiming at nothing more than an invisible point in space. When they reached that imaginary point, they needed to be traveling at a precise speed on a very exact course, then follow an invisible line through space. Thanks to exhaustive practice and the processing power of the Theranan flight control computers, all six ships hit the mark exactly and cut thrust.
Heads up, people. Shields on double aft. Prepare for radiation event.
The other five ships acknowledged well ahead of the deadline, and the computer counted down the time. Exactly on schedule, the Star Carrier appeared behind them in a gamma ray burst, flying in the same direction and slightly slower. When they received the all-clear from Skippy, all six ships decelerated at full power to allow the invisible Star Carrier to catch them. The Dutchman transmitted an extremely faint navigation beacon to avoid the stealth dropships from crashing into the stealth ship. Within 7 minutes of the pirate ship jumping in, the dropships were securely clamped into their docking cradles, and the Flying Dutchman jumped away.